My name's Jim and I'm an alcoholic. I don't know whose story you heard that raised the hair up on your arm, but I certainly don't think it's mine. And Dick, I've met you about 3 or 4 times down at the State Assembly. I must not have made a very big impression. And one time I jumped you about the speaker that was down there, too. You probably remember that. Before I get started, I want to wish everybody, all the men in here, a happy Father's Day. I got phone calls today from all 3 of my daughters. And that's a miracle in itself. Because there was a time when my wife and I were in our kitchen drinking and beating the hell out of each other, and 3 small children were trying to pull us apart. Not a pretty picture, but that's exactly what happened in my life. I guess I'll just start at the beginning. I will give you some statistics. My sobriety date is April 25th, 1981. And I will tell you that my wife is a large part of my story, and she does have 9 months more sobriety than I do. And if I don't tell you that, I'll hear it when I get home. But we just celebrated last Thursday. We celebrated our 49th anniversary. And that's an absolute miracle, because we drank together for 18 years. She was the woman of my dreams, and I tried to run her off. And in some cases, I tried to kill her. Not proud of all of that. I'd like to start off by telling you a little story about, you know how we, I want to take this coat off. It's a little warm up here. My sponsor, he always said, when you show up to speak, you wear a coat. We always put these sponsors on pedestals, and I've got a little story I want to tell you about my sponsor before I get started here. My sponsor is Bill F. from the Lilburn Group. He's one of them. I have 2 sponsors. I've always had 2 sponsors. And Bill invited me to go to dinner with him one night. And so we went to this little restaurant out in Lawrenceville. I'd never been there. And we went in and sat in a booth about halfway to the back of the facility. Well, all the way across the back of the facility was a mirror wall. And Bill's sitting there, and I've got my back to that mirror, and Bill's sitting there talking to me. And all of a sudden, he stopped and said, "You're not going to believe this, but there's 2 guys back there that look just like you and me." And I said, "You're kidding." And he said, "No." And he said, "Don't turn around. Don't turn around." And so he said, "This is amazing." So we sat there a few more minutes, and he said, "Maybe we ought to go back there and talk to them." And I said, "Well, okay." And I started to get up, and he said, "Sit back down. They're coming up here." Well, I started questioning the wisdom of this sponsor of mine. Told you I'd get you. Anyway, I'm gonna talk to you tonight about the journey that I took in my life, and I'll tell you before I get started that it's impossible to go from where I was to where I am today. Absolutely impossible. If you'd read it in a book, you'd say, well, this is fiction. Can't happen. But it did happen. And it happened to me. Those three daughters that I was speaking of, one of them is the oldest one is a black belt Al-Anon. And she started off in Alateen and got into Al-Anon. The youngest daughter of mine, Sheila, who is here with us tonight, has 8 years sobriety. My middle daughter, we don't know what's wrong with her. She just does everything right. She has three kids, and she raises them, and she takes care of them, and she just seems to do everything right. But we're proud of all three of our daughters. My parents didn't raise me to be an alcoholic. My parents raised me to be a Catholic priest. And they almost got their wish. I was raised in Decatur, Georgia. Let me say this. It's really an honor to speak to a group in Atlanta that I don't have to tell you where the varsity is and where all this is, you know. And you know all of that, and you know most of the groups probably that I've attended here. But I was raised in Decatur. Went to Decatur High School. Was raised by a little Irish grandmother and a little Irish Catholic mother. And my dad was a Scotchman. Every time the doors opened at the church, we were there as a child. I guess my mentors and my heroes at that time were all Catholic priests, and they were all good men. You know, there wasn't any, there was nothing out of the way. They were just good men, and they had good morals, and I looked up to them. And I guess that's one of the reasons that I decided after Decatur High School, I decided to go to St. Bernard Seminary in Coleman, Alabama. And my abbot in that seminary is also a member of this fellowship, Father Hillary. And of course, he wasn't sober then, and we would laugh about him being drunk when he'd teach Latin in class, you know, and he couldn't pronounce anything. But I wasn't there long, and I realized that these gentlemen that were over there had something that I didn't have. And I didn't know what it was. I just couldn't figure out what it was they had I didn't have. And I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to find out what that was that they had that I didn't have. And that was a God of their understanding. When I came to AA, I knew who God was, I knew where he lived, and I knew what his name was, but I had absolutely no idea what he had to do with me, because I didn't have a God of my understanding. And so, after a while, I decided that that wasn't right for me, and I notified the abbot that I was leaving, and my parents came and picked me up, and I came home. Now, nobody ever said anything to me that I had been a failure, I had let them down, or anything like that. My parents would have never done that. But inside, I felt like I had failed them. So I went down and joined the United States Air Force. And I took all the tests for aviation cadets to fly. And I passed everything, but they said there are no openings for the flight school at Randolph Field. So why don't you enter the Air Force, and then when we get a opening, we'll notify you. So I did. I joined the Air Force. And went through basic training and went to tech school in Wichita Falls, Texas. And studying aircraft maintenance to be an A&P mechanic. It was there that I basically took my first drink. We were at the club one night, and a guy said, do you want to have a beer? And I said, well, I don't know. I said, I never did like the taste of that stuff. And he said, well, here, let me get you one. So he went and got a pitcher, and he brought the glasses over there, and we sat down, and a few other guys joined us, and we got to drinking, and I got to talking and telling little stories about things that had happened to me in Decatur, Georgia. And of course, a lot of these guys were from up north, and they thought I had a funny accent. But I remember after drinking so much of that beer, I reached a little space in time when everything was okay. And I felt something that I had never felt before. I felt comfortable being around people. I was okay, you were okay, and the world was wonderful, you know. And I had reached that plateau, and I thought, this stuff is wonderful. We left the club that night, and we started back to the barracks, and walking inside the street there, and I took a cigarette and flipped it out in the street, and I heard some brakes. I turned around and looked, and it was the air police. And they had stopped, and they walked over to me and said, Airman, you take that cigarette and you field strip it and put that paper in your pocket. And I said, I'll tell you what you can do with that cigarette. And I was in the paddy wagon, and I was on my way to the brig. Okay, now I'm on my first outing with alcohol, and I've had a good time, but now I'm locked up. And my drill instructor had to come get me out of the brig, and that wasn't a pretty sight in itself. But you know, the next day, I didn't think badly about having to go to the brig. All I could think about was how wonderful this Alexa was that I had drank and what it had done for me, you know, and I spent the rest of my life chasing that little space in time when everything was okay and you were okay and I was okay, and I never could find it ever again, you know. I've always said that one reason I know I'm an alcoholic is because I could walk into a bar and be, my stomach just knotted up, and I could ask the bartender for a scotch and water, and he'd pour it, and I'd reach over and put my hand on the glass, and all of a sudden, I'd ease up, and everything would start getting better. And I hadn't even taken a sip out of that drink. But you see, I knew what was in it. I knew what was in it. I finished my training there, and I went to California. I was stationed in California. And I was waiting for a flight school to open up. And I did the same thing in California. I made friends. All my friends, they drank. At that time, it was 1958, 59, military just seemed to endorse you drinking, you know. They just didn't seem like they thought there was anything wrong with it. And almost encouraged it. I stayed in California about 9 or 10 months, and they came down one day and said that they had an opening in flight school at Orlando Air Force Base. And so I was elated, so I went and packed up my stuff, and I shipped out of there, and went to Orlando, and I got down there, and I was rooming with another guy, and I remember thinking, I can't drink while I'm in this school, because I'll probably flunk out if I do. Isn't that strange? And then all that long, couple of years since I took my first drink, and now I'm thinking, you know, I can do this, but I can't drink if I do it. So subconsciously, I think I knew that alcohol was giving me problems. I went ahead and completed that school, and my roommate, who stayed out every night till 2 o'clock in the morning, and would come in drunk and wouldn't do his work and everything else, he flunked out, and I finished third in my class. So I left there, and I went to the Azores, and I was stationed in Air Sea Rescue, flying C-54s, and life was good. Life was good, you know. But if I wasn't flying and I wasn't on alert and I wasn't on standby, I was at the club. And my drinking was getting worse and worse. I roomed with a guy who just drew trouble. He and I would go drinking together, and the air police would stop us, and he'd try to fight them, and then, of course, I got to help him, you know. And it just got to where it was a bad scene. I pulled that 18 months, and I came back, and I wanted to go back to California. And I got my orders, and it said, "You're going to Dobbins Air Force Base in Marietta, Georgia." And I said, "Well, that's not where I want to go." And I tried everything I could to get my orders changed, because, see, that was only about 18 miles from where I was born and raised, and people knew me, and I knew them. You know, and I wasn't living the type of lifestyle that was conducive to my little Irish mother and my Irish grandmother. But I couldn't get out of it, so I went on and came home and went and reported in at Dobbins, and we had four C-47s and two Convair 440s, and I was on the Convair 440s. And it was a good assignment. I hadn't been there but about 2 months, and I ran into a buddy of mine who was from Decatur. He and I had gone to school together. And he said, "Are you dating anyone?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well," he said, I've got this phone number of this girl that I met, and you might want to call her and see if you'll, you know, you'd like to go out with her." I said, "Okay." So I did. I called her, and I said, "I was wondering if you would like to go out with me." I said, I'm an airman. I'm stationed at Dobbins Air Force Base, flying Convair 440s, you know, anything to impress her. And I said, "I was wondering if you'd like to go out tomorrow night." And she said, "Well, I don't know. I don't think so." She said, "I've got some plans," and said, "I'm going to the lake with some people," and said, "I probably won't be back in time." And I thought, well, doggone, lady. You know, you don't know what you're missing. So I said, "Well, that's it. I don't need her. I won't call her again." So anyway, I called her the next day, and I said, "Would you like to go out with me?" And she said, "Well, okay." And she said the magic thing. She said, "Do you have any beer?" And I said, "Yeah, I can get some beer." And she said, "Well, why don't you get some beer and come on and pick me up?" So I went over to her house and never seen her. It was a blind date. And she came down those steps, and I looked at her, and I said, "You know, she's got something I want, and I'm willing to go to any length to get it." That was long before AA. She was the cutest little 95-pound package of dynamite that I had ever seen. And I don't know but what I didn't fall in love with her right there. And of course, after we went out and we sat at the drive-in and we were watching the movie, and we weren't paying attention to it, we were just talking, and she said, "Well, let's go somewhere where we can talk." And I said, "Okay." I said, "You want to go climb Stone Mountain?" She said, "What's Stone Mountain?" And I said, "Well, come on, I'm going to show you." And at that time, it wasn't a park, it was just a mountain. We went out and we climbed Stone Mountain. And had a wonderful evening, and came home, and I didn't know it till years later, but she went in and told her mother, woke her mother up, said, "I just met the man that I'm going to marry." So I guess I was doomed from that first date, you know. But anyway, she liked the same things I liked. She liked to drink. She liked dance. She liked going to the clubs. She liked the people that I associated with, you know. And we just really hit it off. We were at the club one night, and club closed at 1 o'clock. And I'm trying to impress her, you know. And I said, you ever seen the inside of an airplane? And she said, no. And I said, well, when they close this club, baby, I'm going to take you up and show you an airplane. So they closed the club, and I took her up to the flight line. Well, I knew the tower closed at 11 o'clock at Dobbins, and everything was controlled out of Fulton County Airport. So I put her in that airplane. I put her in the co-pilot seat. I cranked those engines. I pulled those chocks. And I ain't telling you the rest of it, because the statute of limitations may not have run out by now. But she was impressed. I'm going to tell you, she was impressed. I guess if they had caught me, I'd probably still be giving, I'd give this talk from Leavenworth, probably. But anyway, every weekend we were at the club. Every weekend we were at the clubs. If I was in town, if I wasn't flying, you know. We decided to get married, and we got married in 1964. And we were married about, 10 months, and she came home one day and said she was pregnant with our first daughter, Karen. And so I go to the base the next day to tell everybody that I'm going to be a father. And before I could tell them all that, the squadron commander grabbed me and said, I got some news for you. He said, you got orders to go to Vietnam. And I said, well, my wife's pregnant. I said, can I get out of that? Oh, yeah, that's no problem. I'll get you out of it. Well, he got me a six-month deferment. And so as soon as my daughter was born, I left and I went to Vietnam. My life was going to change in many ways at that time. And I didn't even know how many ways it was going to change. But went to Vietnam. I was stationed in Saigon flying C-123s, and we were dropping cargo. We were hauling dead bodies. We were hauling wounded. We dropped flares. I sprayed that awful defoliant called Agent Orange. I sprayed that for 3 months. So there were two things happened to me in Vietnam that were really, really hard for me to handle. And one of them was not getting shot. I got shot in Vietnam, August 16th, 1966. But that wasn't a traumatic thing. The first thing that happened to me was that we picked up a bunch of wounded, and we were hauling them back to Saigon, and there was a boy laying in the floor back there. We just piled him up and laid him in the floor. There was a kid laying in the floor that I looked back, and he looked like my little brother. And when I looked out of the cockpit at him, he smiled at me. And when he did, I smiled back, and I gave him a thumbs up. And he had his hands laying up on him, and he gave me a thumbs up, you know. And in a few minutes, I looked back again, and he had a blank look on his face. And I knew that I was the last person that he had seen before he died. 18 years old, I imagine. This kid looked like about 18 years old. I had never been exposed to death, especially in massive doses of death. And anyway, the second thing that happened to me was we were out flying one day on a mission, and they diverted us to a place called Song Bay. And you had to land on Main Street in town there. And so we landed, and as soon as we landed and got out of the cockpit, this major ran up to us, Army first cow major ran up to us and said, I want you to load the wounded, leave the dead, but get out of here because we cannot hold this field and they're coming up over the end of the runway. So we started running around there dragging the guys that were still alive, and we were dragging them up on the airplane and piling them up. And I remember running back there and looking, and the loadmaster said to me, he said, sir, do you see any more that look like they're alive? And I made a little S run through there, and I didn't see any more that looked like they were alive. We jumped in the airplane. We've had the engines running. We jumped in the airplane, and I released the brakes, and we taxied out and took off. And as you took off from Song Bay, you had to bank to the left, or you'd run into the side of the mountain. And as we banked to the left, I looked back, and I saw two guys sitting up on the end of the runway. And I never will forget, Frank, the co-pilot said, what are you looking at? And I said, nothing. And he said, well, you must see something. What are you seeing? And I said, nothing. And I said, let's go home. I remember thinking, this is something that I'll have to take to my grave. I can't tell anybody I did this. You know, how could I be so callous to leave those two guys there on the side of that runway to the mercy of the enemy? I went back to the crew shack that night. I walked in and I downed about 4 quick beers. Because, see, that was the only thing that would take it away from me. That's the only thing that would give me any peace or any rest. Then I started a pattern of drinking about a half a bottle of scotch a night. Go out and fly 12, 14 hours a day, come back, drink a half a bottle of scotch, and then try to sleep. Wake up screaming, nightmares. One of the guys that I flew with was another one of my heroes. His name was Captain George Grady Cooper. And he was a fine man. And he asked me, would I extend 6 months and stay over there with them and fly another 6 months? And I said, absolutely not. I said, I love you, Grady, but I can't do it. I got to go home. I mean, I could not wait to get out of there. Like I said, I got shot August 16th, 1966. And I came home from Vietnam. And if you looked at my paperwork, you'd say, this man has done well. I had a Purple Heart. I had 29 Air Medals. I had a Commendation Ribbon, which is the same in the Air Force as a Silver Star. I mean, it looked good on paperwork. And I was dying inside. I mean, I was dying inside. We got to San Francisco, and in our orders it had said, change your out of your uniform before you leave San Francisco, which we didn't understand why we had to do that. But I changed into civilian clothes, and when we got to the airport at San Francisco, I found out why they were throwing stuff on us. They'd take Coke bottles and shake them up and spray them on our uniforms. They'd call us baby killers. And I'm thinking, what in the hell has happened to my country? I had no idea. I've been gone for a year. I showed up at the airport in Atlanta, and my wife and my mother were there, and they both asked me, why aren't you in your uniform? And I said, they told us to take it off, come home in civilian clothes. And I kind of felt like I was ashamed that I had gone. And I thought, you know, I just won't tell anybody that I went to Vietnam. I came back and got my wife, and we went to Houston. And took my daughter, my oldest daughter, and we went to Houston, and I was stationed down there flying with a colonel who was commander of the Civil Air Patrol It was a very good assignment. Beautiful airplane. And I just didn't feel like I was a whole person. I'd go flying and I'd come back and I wouldn't come home. I'd go to the bars. And my wife would say, why don't you come home? When you get off the airplane, why don't you come home? And I remember I came in one night and I went right straight to the Hollywood Bar on Old Galveston Road on extension to Houston, Ellington Air Force Base. And this guy sat at the bar there talking to me. He said, well, look at that. And I looked at the door and there stood my wife and my daughter. And my daughter was in her gown and a robe. And my wife's doing this to me. And I walked over there to her and she said, why won't you come home? And I said something to her that was one of the most insensitive things I ever said to her. I said, I dare you come down here and embarrass me in front of my friends. And she said, well, what are these people that you're sitting here drinking with? And I said, these are the only friends I've got. They'll tell you the truth. And actually, they're a bunch of liars and cutthroats, cheats, you know. We know what they are. I wrecked my first automobile while I was in Houston. We had a big argument one night, and I told her, I said, I'm leaving. I'm going to leave you. And I took all my clothes and threw them in the back of this station wagon, and I drove four houses up and hit a parked truck. Life was just deteriorating. I got promoted. I met the promotion board. I got promoted. Here, if you looked at it on paper, this guy's doing great. But don't look inside. I was down at the flight line one day and they said, there's a major up at the operations center looking for you. And I went up there and he said, are you the Jim Metcalf that flew with Grady Cooper? And I said, yes, I did. And he said, well, I came down here from San Antonio to tell you that Grady was killed yesterday. And I immediately thought, you know, if I had stayed in Vietnam and flown with him, he wouldn't have died. It's my fault. He got killed. You know. I went home, took me a bottle of scotch, and I sat down in a recliner, and I sat there and drank almost the whole thing. You know, that was the only thing I knew to do, was to drink. To try to get rid of the pain. Because I just didn't feel like I was physically handling it myself. I got orders to go back to Vietnam. And I said, no way am I going back to Vietnam. No way. I said, I've done my time. My squadron commander said, well, you don't understand, you're in a critical career field and they need you back in Vietnam. And I said, you know why I'm in a critical career field? It's because they're killing everybody over there. When I went over, there were 9 crews of us that went over and there were 4 crews came back. You don't have to take too many trips like that and you know what the story is. We got out of the service and we came home. And I didn't have a job, didn't know what I was going to do. Moved in with her mother. I had dinner with a friend of mine one night. He said, why don't you go out and put in an application with one of the airlines? So I went out and put in an application with the airlines. And the guy said, we're hiring in maintenance and engineering. Then I said, I'll take it. I'll take it because I needed the job. Because Carol was... My wife was expecting, and I didn't have any insurance. So I took the job and went to work for one of the airlines. And we rented a house first, and then we decided to buy us a house. We bought us a little house over in the southeast area of Atlanta. And but I had a hard time working the regimental 8-hour days. I had a hard time with that because I was used to flying all over the world, you know. Not to mention I couldn't sleep at night. And Carol and I would sit around and drink. And she asked me one night, she said, you know, maybe I could help you if you would just tell me what's wrong with you. And you know what I told her? I said, Carol, it is none of your business what's wrong with me. terrible, terrible, hurtful, cruel things. You know, we don't think about how important words are. You know, we use words like that, and then we go make amends, but it's still, the words are still there. They're still a hurt. We started running with our old gang back up around the base, going to the clubs, all of that, and life just continued to deteriorate. We lost all our friends. I remember when my last buddy called me and told me, said, we love going out with y'all, but we just can't be around you because you're like a stick of dynamite and we never know when you're going to go off. And Ann and I have talked about it and we've just decided we can't be around you anymore. And I hung the phone up and I said, well, that's it. That's my last friend. I don't have any friends anymore. And so our kitchen table became our bar. And my wife was drinking as bad as I was. And so we sit around this bar. And, you know, we'd sit down at night and we'd say, you know, we got all these problems we need to work on. And let's sit down and talk about them constructively tonight. And she'd say, that's a good idea. And I'd say, but hand me a beer before you sit down. And that's the way it would start. You know, that's the way it would start. And then you know how it ended up. It ended up terrible. We were sitting there one night about midnight, and I got up and went to the bathroom. Both of us, three sheets in the wind. I came back and the phone's off the hook, and she says, the telephone's for you. And I thought, well, that's strange. I didn't hear the phone ring. So I picked up the phone, and I said, hello? This guy said, Jim. I said, yeah. He said, my name's Jim, too, and I'm an alcoholic. And I said, I'm sorry. And I thought, why would he call me and tell me that? Well, she had called the answering service. And I said, I think you need to talk to my wife. She's the one who's got the problem. And I gave her the phone and I told her, I said, don't you ever do this to me again. And I went to bed. Later on, we were sitting around the table there and she was talking and she said, you need to make up your mind what you're going to do. And I said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to kill myself. So I went in there and I got a pistol. I laid it down on the kitchen table and I said, you can sit and watch this if you want to, or you don't have to, but I'm going to shoot myself. And I said, life is not worth living. And she got up and went in the other room. And when she did, I just took that pistol and shot it right out the window. I don't know what my neighbors thought down there behind us. She came running back in, and she said, I thought you had done it. But that's how bad my life was. My life was terrible. I left her at the table one night, and she was crying, and I said, I'm going to tell you something. I said, I'll tell you what the problem is. The problem is you're crazy. You are absolutely crazy. And I said, I may or may not stay here, but I said, you're crazy. And I went to bed. I came home from work the next day and she said, I'm going to a meeting. And I said, what kind of meeting are you going to? She said, I'm going to an AA meeting. And she said, I've already taken care of everything. She said, the kids are ready for bed and the dinner's in the stove and I'm going to meet her. I said, okay. And she left. So she did that for a while. And the same routine every night. Then I came home one day and she said, would you like to go over to this meeting with me? And I said, okay. So she took me over to the Tucker Group. And we were living in Gwinnett County. So she took me over to the Tucker Group. And we went in and it was a big, big meeting, a lot of people. And she said, when they split up, you go in that room and I'll go in this room. I said, okay. So they split up and I went in this room and I sat down next to this man. And when they went around the room, they were saying, my name's Fred, I'm an alcoholic, you know. When they got to me, I said, my name's Jim and my wife says I have a drinking problem. And the guy sitting next to me said, I doubt that very seriously. You know, he and I became good best friends right there, buddy. I'm telling you. I mean, this man could see what was going on. And I said, are you serious? You don't think I am? And he said, no. He said, I probably spilled more liquor than you ever drank, son. And I said, well, when this meeting's over, would you step out to the car and tell my wife that? He said, I'd be glad to. So when the meeting was over, I went out, and she's sitting in the car in the driver's seat. And I said, Carol, I said, this man's got something he wants to tell you. And he says, ma'am, I don't think this boy's an alcoholic. He said, I don't think he's drinking enough liquor. Carol said, get in the car. And I said, listen to the man. She said, get in the car. And I got in the car, and she took me home. I had gone into an AA meeting and found an ally. You know? How many times would that happen? Anyway, life went on like that, and she quit going to meetings. And then I came home one day, and she said, I'm going back to AA. And I said, okay, fine. So she started going to the meetings, and it was the same routine every night. Your dinner's in the stove. I'm going to a meeting. And she was going to the Clarkston group. And she'd say things like, well, Gay says I don't have to do this, or I don't have to do that. And I'm thinking, who the hell is Gay? You know? I just wasn't understanding anything that she said. We weren't even on the same wavelength. So, I came in one night, and I had stopped by the beer store. I'd stopped and looked at a boat first on the way home. And I thought, maybe I need a fishing boat. You know, this one had a nice cooler in it and everything. Got around the corner, had it for sale, $500. So I came home and I got out of the car and I walked in. I got this 12-pack hanging over my shoulder. You know, they got those plastic things, you know. And I started in the door and she opened the door and she said, where are you going? I said, well, I'm coming in the house. And she said, not in this house. She said, we don't have alcohol in this house. And I looked over her shoulder and I knew she was serious because she'd gone and got her mother. And her mother's there shaking her head like, that's right, that's right. I told her, I said, I'll be right back. I got in my truck, I went around the corner, I bought that boat. I went by and got some ice and ice, throw my beer down in that cooler. I backed that boat up beside my house, which between me and the neighbors wasn't as far as from here to that wall. But I backed that boat up there. And I said, you go to your meetings, you have a good time, I'll be sitting right here. I crawled up in that boat and I'd sit there and drink those beers while she was gone to the meeting. I often wondered what my neighbors thought was going on over there, you know. She drives off and here I am sitting in the boat drinking beer. Things got worse and worse. And finally, the thing came to a head. I walked into the house one Saturday afternoon and she's on the phone with somebody and she says, I love you too, darling, and I'll see you tonight. And she hung up. I said, oh man, I got her. I got her now. Gonna get the house, the car, everything. And she says, would you like to go to Clarkston with me tonight? I said, love to. Love to. So we went over to Clarkston that night, and I thought, you know, I'll know who it is when I walk in. I have a pretty good eye. I can spot these guys, you know. We walked in the door there, and a girl named Barbara A. jumped up and ran over there and hugged my wife and says, I love you, sweetie. I'm so glad to see you. And I thought, you know, I got more troubles than I thought I had. I couldn't believe it. I didn't see anything. I sat down there that night and I at that meeting and I listened and a guy was talking, a guy named Gordon Carrington. I don't know what ever happened to him. Had one of the most horrendous stories you've ever heard in your life. But when he started talking about how he felt, I started that twitching and moving around because I could understand exactly what he was saying about how he felt. I couldn't sleep at night, you know, about how he had to have that next drink. He just couldn't visualize not drinking. He had me right there. So I told her, I said, take me home. So we got up and left. She took me home. My last drink was about 3 weeks later. And we were going out to her mother's in Lawrenceville, and she and her mother were going shopping, and her stepfather and I were going to watch the ball game. And I remember sitting there, and I remember going out there on the way from Stone Mountain to Lawrenceville, and she said, as we come home, be sure and stop and get some milk, because kids don't have milk. And I said, okay. So we got out there, and she and her mother went shopping, and her stepfather and I sat down there and started drinking. And I remember it opening the third beer. And I don't remember anything after that. I woke up Sunday morning, and I'm in my bed, and I'm thinking, how did I get here? And how did I get home? So I got out of bed, and I was getting dressed, and she said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to the store and get some milk. She said, we don't need any milk. I said, oh, okay. So I got back in bed, and I waited a little while. I got up again. She said, where are you going? I said, we got to have some milk. She said, we don't need milk. So I walked in there and looked in the refrigerator, and there's a gallon of milk in the refrigerator. I walked outside, and I walked around my car, you know how we do, see if there's anything missing, like a fender. And I looked at my car, and I'm thinking, I don't know how I got home. And how'd I get that damn milk? But I ain't saying nothing. You know, you can't tell them. So it eat on me all day Sunday. And then Monday, I went to work, and I only worked a half a day. And I came home, and I thought, I got to get out here and cut the grass. And I got outside there in the backyard, and I'm on the lawnmower, and I'm going around and around and around. And I'm crying. That's the first time I cried in 16 years. And cried since I left Vietnam. And you know how guys cry in the service, I bet you know. You go in the shower and you let the water run over you and you just stand there and cry. But I hadn't cried in 16 years. And I'm out there on that lawnmower and I'm crying like a baby and I can't stop. I walk back in the house and I told her, I said, I got to take a shower. I took a shower and she said, where are you going? I said, I'm going down to Memorial Drive to that meeting down there, and I got to have somebody to talk to. And she said, it's the milk, isn't it? I said, yeah, that's the milk. I don't remember getting the milk. And she said, well, you stopped at Kroger's and went in and got the milk and came out. And I said, did I drive us home? She said, yeah. So I left and I went down to Memorial Drive. It's the Memorial Drive Beginners Group down there. And I walked in. And the first guy I saw was a guy that was about 6'4", and had this deep voice. And he said, my name's Hal Hubbard. Can I help you? And I said, yeah. I said, I'm trying to find out how you know you're an alcoholic. I said, I came down here to get some information. And he said, well, I can't tell you you're an alcoholic. He said, but I can tell you that I'm an alcoholic. And he said, I'll tell you that if you are an alcoholic, you don't have the three choices. He said, you can come go with us and get sober, or you'll die in a mental institution, or you'll die at your own, as a result of your own hand. He said, that's all you got. And he said, let me tell you a little bit about me. And he started telling me about Hal, same thing with Gordon. I started getting uncomfortable. I'm thinking, man, don't tell me no more, you know. He said, why don't you stick around here for the meeting? I said, no, I don't want to interrupt y'all's meeting. I just get a little information. Appreciate it. And I was going down to on Memorial Drive, 285 there, where my watering hole was. I was going to go down there and get me a drink because I was just about to fly apart. And I remember thinking on the way home, you know, my life has either got to get better or it's got to get over. One or the other, get better or get over. I pulled out of that driveway, and I don't know why, but I didn't go to the liquor store. I turned around and I came home. The next day I called this guy, Hal, and I said, would you meet me again and talk to me? And he said, yeah, there's a meeting at Clarkston, 8 o'clock. I'll meet you at 7, let's talk. I said, okay. So I met him over there at 7, and we talked before the meeting. And I'm going to tell you, this is how sick I was. We went in that meeting and we sat down, and I'm in the back of the room on the aisle, and he had told me about the chips. And so this girl, same girl, Barbara A., gets up and she's giving out the chips. And she says, would anyone here tonight like to have a white chip and try our way of life? And Hal nudges me and says, that one's got your name on it, buddy. And I jumped up and ran up there to get it. And before I got there, this girl named Lynn got up and got that chip. And I'm trying to take it away from her because it's got my name on it. And Barbara said, what are you doing? We got a whole basket full of them here. Then I realized there wasn't any names on them. Hal became my first sponsor. And I spent more time with Hal Hubbard the first year of my sobriety than I did with my family. But I needed to. I needed to. I spent every Saturday with him. Every Saturday morning with him, we'd meet at Stone Mountain. And I needed it. I really needed it. But you know, sponsors say the stupidest things. I called him one day and I said, Hal, I said, I don't think I'm going to the meeting tonight. And he said, okay, that's fine. He said, pick me up at 7 o'clock. I said, Hal, you don't understand. I don't think I'm going. He said, don't you understand? We don't care what you think. You think anything you want to as long as you do what we tell you to do. I picked him up every night, and we went to meetings together. I worked the steps, 1 through 12, first time with Hal Hubbard. I need to tell you about my 90-day revelation. I decided at 90 days I was going to go out and drink. And so I was supposed to go to the meeting, and I told my wife, I said, I'm going to the meeting, I'll see you, and I got in the car. I was going over to Glenwood. There was a place over there called Crosby's. And I knew the guy that was singing over there, and of course I knew a lot of the people at the bar too. And I was going to go over there and drink. And on the way over there, I realized I was only 2 blocks from my sponsor's house. And so I turned to the right and I went down there by his house. And of course, he'd gone to the meeting. And I sat there and I cried. And I was in so much pain, I wanted to take a bite out of that steering wheel. Well, I didn't know it, but he had invited everybody to come to his house after the meeting for pizza. And I'm sitting there in the car, and all of a sudden, here come all these cars, just one right after another. A guy named Paul Eddy, who, God, I loved him, came up to the car and said, what's going on with you, Junior? And I said, Paul, I said, I want to drink so bad I can't stand it. And he says, go on in the house. So I went in the house with him, and there was a guy named Jim Lowry was there who eventually became one of my sponsors. And I don't know whether Bill was there or not, but there were about 12 men there. And Paul said, have you ever asked God to remove the compulsion to drink? I missed that one. And I said, Paul, I have never done that. He said, well, we're going to do it tonight. And he said, come on, guys. And all 12 of those men went in there in Hal's bedroom. They closed the door, and we knelt down around the bed. Now, if you never knew Paul Eddy, he was a Blackfoot Indian and the most spiritual man I ever knew. And he said something like this. He said, O Great Spirit, please hear Jim's request tonight. He wants to quit drinking, and he's never asked you to remove the compulsion to drink. O Spirit, please hear his voice tonight. And he says, it's all yours. And he turned it over to me. And I started crying. I said, God, please remove the compulsion to drink. I don't want to drink anymore. And we closed it, standing up around Hal's bed, singing the Our Father. Those are the kind of men that I was exposed to when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I only had two sponsors at a time, but let me tell you something. I had so many more mentors. Frankie Rice was one of them. He was such an inspiration on my life, you know. Pool Boy Rice. All of those people were mentors to me. And I learned so much. I learned so much about living. I went to the Biscayne Room one night with a guy named Roy Comer. On the way home, he pulled in the driveway and shut the key off, and he said, you about ready to talk about it? And I said, talk about what? He said, talk about Vietnam. And Roy had been a pilot who flew in and out of Vietnam. And he knew I was dying on the vine. And I said, maybe I can just crack a door here. And so I opened the door just a little, and I shared with Roy about what was going on in my life. And things started happening. I took my fourth step, and in taking my fourth step, I called Hal, and I said, it's complete. And he said, is it completely complete? And I said, yeah. And he said, what about 1965? And I said, oops, I forgot about that. I had not written the first word about Vietnam. He said, go back and write. I went back and wrote. You know, I was able to get some relief by working that fourth step and sharing it with Hal in my fifth step. And then I went down and shared it with Father Damien at the monastery. And I felt it was necessary that I share it with him. I had about a year and a half, 2 years sobriety. And Hal went back out and drank. And the next Saturday, I got that phone call that we all dreaded. And Hal's wife said, Hal went outside this morning, sat down by a tree, and put a pistol in his mouth and killed himself. I was devastated. But you see, what he told me that first night was true. I don't have three choices. I don't know why Hal did that. I'll never know why Hal did that. I immediately went and got Hal's sponsor, who happened to be a guy named Jim Lowry. And I never will forget, I said, Jim, will you be my sponsor? And he said, Mickey, I've been sponsoring you for years and you didn't even know it. And he became a strong part of my life. A strong part of my life. A lot of people didn't get to know the inner side of this man, but he was the most warm, caring person that I ever met. I worked the steps again all the way through, 1 through 12, with Jim. And I've always had a sponsor named Jay, who lives in Monroe, but I've always had two sponsors. Jim Lowry died, and when he died, Bill and I went to the funeral. And after the funeral, I asked Bill, I said, I need a sponsor. And Bill's been right there for me. He absolutely has, you know. About three years ago, I was invited to go to Jekyll Island and speak at the Serenity Weekend. And I didn't really want to do it, but I did. And I told this guy from down in Brunswick, was a good friend of mine, and he asked me, he said, please do it. And I said, okay. And so I went down there, and I told him, I said, Donnie, I said, I want to be the Thursday night speaker. I don't want to be the Saturday night speaker. I want to be the Thursday night speaker. And he said, okay, you can be the Thursday night speaker. When I got down there, they had all the flyers printed up, and I was the Saturday night speaker. I said, Donnie, I wanted to be the Thursday night speaker. He said, well, I'm sorry, they'd already printed these flyers up, and you're the Saturday night speaker. I got up that Saturday night, and I spoke. And I told about my experiences, just like I have tonight. And after the meeting, a guy came up to me, and he looked very tattered. And he was crying like a baby. And he hugged me, and he said something to me that I didn't understand. And I couldn't understand what he was saying because he was crying so bad. And I said, yeah, it's okay, it's okay. And I just kind of left it at that. And he finally walked off. The next morning, I went to check out of the hotel, and I went into the hospitality room to get a cup of coffee before I left. And he was in there, and he ran over to me. And he said, did you understand what I was trying to tell you last night? And I said, no, I didn't. And he said, what I was trying to tell you was that I was in the first division at Somme Bay, and I came out on the last airplane, and we all got out. We all got out. I thought to myself, after 28 or 29 years, God probably looked down on me and said, I think he suffered enough. I think he suffered enough. What if I'd have got tired after 25 years and just said, I'm not going to meetings anymore. I don't need it. Would I have missed it? I'd have missed it. I want to tell you a little story. Wrap this thing up. There was a little boy who was raised on a farm down in Jessup, Georgia. And his parents were sharecroppers and they didn't have any money. But one day the circus was coming to town, and his mother said, I think he's 16 years old and he needs to see the circus. And so they mustered up 50 cents and they gave it to him and said, son, we want you to go to town Saturday morning. The circus is going to be here and we want you to see the circus. And he was just elated. And so he ran to town on Saturday morning. And he's got right on the outskirts of town. Here comes the parade for the circus. And the lions and the tigers and the monkeys and the trapeze people and everything are coming down the street. And he was elated. He had never seen anything like that in his life. The last people that came by were the clowns. And this clown came by on these stilts. And he took his top hat off and tipped him over to the boy, and the boy put his 50 cents in and ran home and told his parents how wonderful the circus was. You see, he didn't see the circus. He saw the parade. I challenge you tonight, and I ask you, are you getting everything out of Alcoholics Anonymous that is here for us to get out of? Are you seeing the circus, or are you just seeing the parade? I can test if you stay long enough, you'll see the circus. I can't stand here tonight and tell you that I have not seen the circus. Because I believe that I haven't seen the whole circus. And more will be revealed to us if we keep coming. You know, if we keep coming. It's a wonderful thing to be asked. It's a very humbling thing to be asked to come speak before you people. 72 years anniversary of AA in Atlanta. And I got to be a part of it. And I want to close tonight, like I usually do, by saying I want to thank the God behind Sandy and you lovely people in Alcoholics Anonymous for giving me back my life. Thank you.